Walking along the beaches of Sarachev Island, you might find hundreds of sea stars. Or you might find bones, bits left over from subsistence hunting, a seal flipper, the hoof and shin of a caribou. Sarachev is a barrier island off the northwest coast of the Seward Peninsula. A few miles long and a quarter mile wide, you can stand in the middle and see ocean on both sides. There is one village on Sarachev. This is Shishmaref. Shishmaref has gained national attention in recent years, not for its beauty or its history, but for its future. Shishmaref is one of 31 coastal communities in Alaska that the U.S. Government Accountability Office found to be in imminent danger of flooding and erosion. That was 8 years ago. As waves have eaten away the edge of the island, photographs of houses dangling over the sea and collapsing in on themselves had reporters and politicians around the world calling the village of Shishmaref an early victim of climate change. But there's something wrong with that picture. The people who call Shishmaref home are not just standing by to watch their island wash away. I traveled to Shishmaref earlier this month, and I met a handful of people, some of them very young, who are eager to learn all they can about the changes and challenges facing their home, and they're figuring out what they can do about it. Turns out, it might have something to do with berries. My name is Zoe Gruskin, and this is Story 49.
The spring came when it usually comes, and the flowers on the blackberries flowered just when they usually did, and then they made little unripe berries, and then they made beautiful ripe berries.
That's Krista Mulder. She's a professor of ecology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but today she's in Shishmaref, hoping to get kids thinking about berries with a play. Krista is the lead scientist on an ambitious new project with at least two distinct goals. First, the researchers want to know what happens to a few kinds of common berries over the fall and winter across the entire state of Alaska. To do that, they'll need a lot of help. So they have another question. What makes regular, non-scientist citizens want to get involved? The project is called Winterberry, and the principal investigator is Krista's former graduate student, Katie Spellman. And then there's Katie's sister.
I'm Lisa Villano, and I'm a special ed teacher here in Shishmaref.
Lisa is not a scientist, but she's been wondering how to talk about climate change with some of the youngest kids on the island. With her husband, Chioki Brent, Lisa is starting a school club called Climate Heroes for kids in kindergarten through third grade. Climate change is affecting everyone on the island, but she says most of the existing classes and opportunities to get involved are aimed at older students.
We wanted to give the little ones a chance to have something for them and to start learning real young how to take ownership and stewardship over their home, too.
Which is not to say the kids don't know anything about climate change. Lisa and Chioki, who have lived in Shishmaref for 2 years, understand that while most students in the lower 48 hear about it in school and in the news, kids in Shishmaref have grown up with climate change.
The kids here, they see it, they grow up with it, they live with it.
I think that just being a kid here, you have some sort of an understanding. They see it. And because their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents are talking about it.
But how to give kids something they could hold on to? Enter the berries.
As soon as you mention berries, people get very, very interested.
You might be wondering what berries have to do with climate change. Well, berries, like all plants, depend on the weather and seasons to grow. And people throughout Alaska depend on berries.
It's sustenance.
Yeah, it's sustenance.
Yeah.
It's the one source of fruits, unless you're going to pay a fortune and get really bad quality stuff from a long way away.
Scientists know that climate change is already affecting when seasons arrive and the weather throughout the year. But Krista says no one really knows how those changes will impact berries. The Winterberry team chose four common species, highbush cranberry, lowbush cranberry, prickly rose, and crowberry. Together, these berries grow in almost every part of the state. In Shishmaref, it's crowberries, or sometimes they're just called blackberries. They grow low to the ground on much of the island and are gathered throughout the summer. The ones I tried tasted a little like watery grapes. Nice, but with a bitter aftertaste, and a thick skin and hard seeds. I was told they get sweeter after the first frost, or in the freezer, and that they're great for baking and jam. Lisa learned about the Winterberry Project from her sister Katie, and she and Chioki thought it would be a perfect start for the Climate Heroes. Krista wants to know what really works when it comes to getting citizens to volunteer their time for a science project based far away. Does it help if you visit in person? She decided to head to Shishmaref to find out. Along with Jasmine Shaw, a UAF Cooperative Extensions assistant and leader of a similar kids group in Sitka, Krista arrived in Lisa's classroom to try to get kids excited about studying berries, with pictures, plants, and yes, a play.
But then the next year, the spring came really, really early, and the flowers bloomed really early, and the green berries grew really early, and they turned black really early.
Once Krista felt like the kids had a handle on things, everyone headed out into the field to do some real science. Each young climate hero picked three crowberry plants they will personally keep track of over the fall and winter. The kids marked their chosen plants with bright pink ribbons, and Krista and Jasmine helped them record the condition of all the berries. How many berries on the plant are ripe, unripe, rotten, dried out, or damaged?
I have a good plant here. Let's see if we can find one that has more than one berry on it.
Oh, I got one. Oh, I got a good one. Manny, don't step on your plant.
Oh, I see two berries on that one. One of them's kind of squishy and icky, and I also see an unripe one. Look at that. Ooh, that's going to... No, don't pull it off, don't pull it off, okay? Remember, we're going to watch what happens to it.
Krista's expertise is ecology, so she says she's been figuring out the rest of the stuff as she goes, like how to explain the science to young kids. And what helps them feel invested?
We've made some really bad mistakes and we've learned from them. So in our very first citizen science project, we said, okay, everybody's going to track five plants and, you know, you're going to tell us the data. And we numbered them 1 through 5 and people went off and data would come back. And like, wow, these data are all over the place. I couldn't make sense of them. And then I realized them that people would go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then the next time, what they called plant number 1 had been plant number 3, you know, the week before. They weren't keeping track. And so Katie hit on this brilliant idea of what if we named them? Because you're not going to call a plant that you named Susan in week 1, Robert in week 2, you know.
Beth, what did you name your berries?
Thor, Cupcake, Rosie.
Nice. What is Cupcake?
It's a Eskimo name.
What does it mean?
Wolverine.
Wolverine, cool. Of course, not all of Krista's findings are equally useful.
The most popular name by far for a plant is Bob. last project when we finished, we had 17 plants named Bob across like 16 schools. And I'm just like, really? You know, I mean, what's with that? So I have no idea what you do with a discovery like that. You know, I mean, it's not exactly publishable.
Manny!
Manny!
Why? Hey,
right here!
It was a beautiful afternoon, perfect for berry picking, or rather, berry tagging, though Lisa thought the nice weather might be one reason why turnout was low for climate heroes that day. But Lisa, Chioki, and Krista were pleased with the enthusiasm.
When we were walking to our site, Manny, I was watching him, and, you know, he'd kind of, you know, run to meet the other little kids that were playing on the playground, but he had his clipboard, and he would tell them, "I'm going to study the berries now." like he was committed. I felt like that showed like he thought this was cool. He felt involved. He felt some ownership. And then I heard earlier today a staff member told me that Beth wouldn't let her parents leave as excited as she was for the boating trip that she kept talking about. She wouldn't let her parents leave until after she came here. She said, "We have to come and meet the scientists."
Yeah. You can come next time if you would like.
Right.
Every Monday, 4 o'clock.
Okay, now this one's a little bit more interesting. How many berries can you find?
One.
This one? I see some more. Gotta look carefully.
And Aaron, you could do this too if you wanted.
Well, I just see one.
I see one there, but I also see one there. Do you see that one?
Yep.
Is that one ripe?
Yes.
You think so? Would you eat it?
Mm-mm.
No? What does
I
that
would
mean?
Eat that one.
You would eat that one. So that one's ripe. So what? Do you remember what it's called when something's not ripe?
There's some over here, Grandma.
I just call that unripe. It means not ripe.
I really love watching kids get into it. You know, I love, I mean, they get really excited about it. And they discover that science isn't scary, that it's fun, that scientists are real people, we do things just like other people do. We're real people. And I think that's really satisfying for me.
Now, this one, do you remember what I said I would call that? oldy, moldy, stinky, the kind of thing you left in your lunchbox for a week? Yeah, right in the rotten category. I would put a one there because that's a rotten berry. Yeah, you can erase it. That's okay. I make mistakes all the time when I collect data. That's just normal. You just have to make sure to write it again. That's why I always use pencil. That's what scientists do. We use pencil because we make mistakes.
Krista emphasizes that learning about climate change is not just doom and gloom.
So one of the goals of a lot of these projects that we're involved in is actually to give people the resources and the background, the information, so that people can make decisions about, you know, what to do and how to adapt, and to not have everything be dark and dire and miserable. But there are things you can do. There's some advantages. You know, as you get longer growing seasons, there's more species, for example, that'll grow, more plants that you can grow, more food resources that you can use. One of the things that I'm finding is that berries are more unpredictable. And one comment we've heard from people repeatedly is, well, I don't know, should I pick for 1 year or for two? And that actually matches my data very nicely. So one of the things we're trying to do is to give people, you know, the information that we can. I mean, we're not making decisions for people. It's up to people themselves. But we can provide some resources. This is what we think is going to happen. And, you know, have people make the best decision they can based on the best information we have. We don't have much information, which is why we really want, you know, we really are dependent on people helping us out gathering information.
What do you think is going to happen to the berries in 2 weeks?
Great. So next two, oh, we have to do one more thing.
Would someone take them?
Hopefully not, because we put this tag on there with the pink. So hopefully they know that they shouldn't pick them, because it's science.
You know what you write here?
The Climate Heroes in Shishmaref will be part of a statewide network of berry tracking volunteers. Everyone who participates in Project Winterberry will have access to all the data, and Krista and her team want to build connections between the groups. Lisa is hoping her students can be pen pals with a 4-H club monitoring berries in Sitka. Chioki says fostering these connections is exactly what Climate Heroes is all about.
It's about bringing everyone together. We can't really stop climate change, but we can definitely raise awareness. And in order to do that, everybody has to come together, share their own stories, their own facts, their own experiences, and so we can know not necessarily how to solve it, but how to adjust to it.
With their berries all named, tagged, and recorded, there was just one thing left that day for the climate heroes.
We have a muffin. We put huckleberries from Sitka and the ones that look kind of red and purplish, and then we put blackberries that we picked here, as well as dried cranberries in the other one.
Nice. Hey, Beth, we got a treat for you.
Yeah, that made her come running.
On the second floor of the Shishmaref City Building, a few doors down from the bingo department, I met the village's young climate change coordinator. Corey Ningaluk, 20 years old, works in an office papered with maps and photographs of Shishmaref's crumbling edges. He's held the position since June 1st, and since then he's conducted a survey of residents' preparedness for change, and he's guided plenty of visiting journalists and dignitaries around the island. He shares some history and shows them what they came to see. Or rather, he tells them about what they can't see, not anymore. A beach where he walked as a child. Houses that used to sit high on the edge of the land. These are his own memories.
I was maybe like 5. It was a weekend. There was school already started. And I was walking the beach. And I remember there's this boat being built right on a cliff. Like a dream.
That cliff is gone. Now there's just a seawall, which is just a narrow band of jumbled rocks. Corey told me he's still settling into his new position. Mostly right now he's doing a lot of research and figuring out what he hopes to accomplish. He is Shishmaref's first official climate change coordinator, although he told me others have done similar work before him. Corey has spent his entire life in Shishmaref, population about 600. Like many young men on the island, he's grown up hunting with his family.
I started following my dad, like the fourth grade. In the spring, I would follow him. I liked it since the first trip, as much as I slept the whole trip, or most of it. It's beautiful out there on the nice days. I just love it. Like, like somebody asked me if going hunting, like, why do you even ask? Just tell me you're going and I'll follow.
Like all hunters, Corey pays close attention to the weather and the turning of the seasons. Different times of year mean different hunts.
I'm getting excited for the fall seal hunting and looking forward to getting a moose. I've never got one before. In summertime, caribou, and I'm a big spring hunter. I go out hunting in the springtime looking for bearded seals and walrus. Like, that's where my new year starts, is when spring gets here.
But exactly when spring gets here and what it looks like has been changing in Shishmaref. Corey hears about it from his family, and he sees it himself.
I hear it every year from my dad. And this year was very different because we only went boating once. That's pretty strange. It's because the ice is just melting that fast. I can tell a difference by warmer winters. Last year we had open water in December. On New Year's it was raining. To go hunting, we need to be able to predict the weather.
As vital as subsistence hunting is to the community, the problem isn't just that warmer winters and unpredictable weather are making hunting harder and more dangerous. The entire island is at stake.
When we get north wind, usually the tide gets low. But a few times we had north wind, the water level was high, and that could take our island away.
Shishmaref is washing away at an alarming rate. A state-funded study last year found that the shoreline has lost more than 200 feet since 1969. It's a compound problem. As temperatures rise, there's less sea ice to protect the island from storm surges. At the same time, the island's permafrost is melting, destabilizing the land and making it even more vulnerable to erosion. Rising sea levels only make things worse. Since the 1970s, there's been talk in Shishmaref of doing something that would be unthinkable for a community almost anywhere else in the world, moving the entire town. In Alaska, though, dozens of coastal villages are considering relocation. Earlier this year, one of these villages, Newtok, in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, even broke ground on a new site with a new name. Last August, Shishmaref held a vote on relocation. It was close. 78 residents voted to stay put on Sarachev Island. 89 voted to move on to mainland Alaska. But just because the village voted to move doesn't mean anything's happened. Relocation will be extraordinarily expensive, at least $180 million, and that was a figure from a 13-year-old estimate. Actually, the 2016 vote wasn't the first time Shishmaref decided to move itself. The yes votes won a similar poll back in 2002, but the village lacked funding to carry it out. For many on Shishmaref, including Corey, it's more than just the money that worries them.
If that vote were happening right now, do you know what you would say?
Yeah, I know what I'd say. I wouldn't want to move. The location of this island is, I just love it, I guess. Having water on both sides and going boating. I know the weather's not as predictable as it was. I think I could see, like, us moving, but I don't want to say I can see it. I don't feel like moving. I think it would be too different after growing up on an island. It would be more safe, but I don't know. My mom, we just moved into a new house at the east end of town. I miss our old house because of the location. I see that as the same way as moving the village.
Talking to Corey and others in Shishmaref about climate change and the precarious future of their village, I was surprised that no one talked about being scared. Even when telling me about storms that had toppled houses and washed away chunks of the island, more than anything, Corey sounded impressed by the sea.
I just love the ocean, I guess. I remember when a big storm came in, like, 2004, and we would get off school, some kids my age, and the water was so high that it would go so back, and another big wave would come. We'd go to, like, these little high spots and run on the beach while the water's retreating.
Seems pretty dangerous.
Yeah, but that's just who we were at that age, I guess.
The kids naming berries that afternoon didn't seem scared either. although it wasn't entirely clear to me what they think about being climate heroes, or even how much they understand climate change and what it could do to their island. Chioki says mostly they seem curious, and he and Lisa think that's a good place to start. It was a gorgeous afternoon, a Friday. Many of Shishmaref's families had left for a long weekend or were about to go, including Corey's and Beth's. In a couple hours, they'd be in boats on their way to camp, and I'd be walking around the island. I'd poke at bones on the beach and watch a gigantic moon float over mainland Alaska. The mainland. If the people of Shishmaref really do relocate, that's where they'll be. Like Corey said, they'll be safer, but... For now, though, they've got the island. A few miles long and a quarter mile wide. It's beautiful, and it's home. Thank you to everyone who made this episode possible. Special thanks to Krista Mulder, Lisa Villano, Chioki Brent, Jasmine Shaw, Beth and Catherine Kakiak, Manny and Rebecca Trunke, and Corey Ningaluk. Music in this episode by Mystery Mammal and Poddington Bear. If you or someone you know has a story to share, contact KNOM at 443-5221 or by email at story49@knom.org. Story 49, sharing your story, your voice, your Alaska.